Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's really hard to get people to elicit and actually express what is something that is just so obvious to them. And whenever I tried to sort of ask about the details, like how do people get poisoned? Like how does it get into the food? Where does it come from? I would get this pretty standard response of, well, how would I know? I don't poison people.
Georgina Ramsey spent time with refugees in Uganda. She brings us a story of insecurity. Food insecurity, yes, but also an existential insecurity that comes from having to restart your life in a new country. And then with Daniel Orr, your shopping list, butter, garlic, lemon, rye bread, and flowers, and then ingredients birds will like, seeds, nuts, oats, peanut butter, and a heaping cup of lard. First up today, Sonny Perdue's confirmation hearings finally begin. Here's Mark Chilla.
Right, Annie. Perdue is President Donald Trump's pick to lead the Agriculture Department. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue was the last cabinet secretary nomination Trump announced more than 2 months ago. Some senators have said one reason it's taken so long for confirmation hearings is that Perdue had to unravel himself from many agribusiness dealings in order to comply with financial disclosure and ethics requirements. The Agriculture Department has nearly 100,000 employees and includes a wide range of programs from the Forest Service and animal disease monitoring to food stamps, farm subsidies, and conservation. Despite the delays, observers predict a smooth confirmation. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The USDA's head veterinarian says the agency is preparing to combat the strain of bird flu that has killed some 140 people in China this year. Though no one can forecast how a virus will travel or the ways it may mutate, the USDA's Dr. Jack Shear says it's possible that wild birds could bring the deadly virus over from China. An outbreak of bird flu in 2015 killed 48 million birds, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the public health risk to people from strains recently found in U.S. poultry is low. Brazilian federal police raided two of the country's largest meat producers after tips that employees had bribed inspectors to overlook rotten and tainted meat. The companies BRF and JBS are Brazil's largest food processing companies, with exports around the world. U.S. chicken producer Pilgrim's Pride is a subsidiary of JBS. Accusations against the company include bribing inspectors to allow salmonella-tainted meat to make its way to Italy, using chemicals to mask the odor and color of rotten meat, and falsifying documents. A top government relations executive with BRF turned himself into police for questioning over the weekend. Both companies have denied any wrongdoing. Meanwhile, this week, China suspended imports of all Brazilian meat following the scandal. And President Donald Trump announced his proposed budget last week, under which Meals on Wheels would face huge cuts in funding. While not a federal program, Meals on Wheels gets money from a mix of state, local, and federal government funds. The service receives federal dollars through the Administration for Community Living, an agency of the Department of Health and Human Services that serves the elderly and disabled. The proposed federal budget cuts funding to the Department of Health and Human Services by 18%, or $15.1 billion. Meals on Wheels is also funded by grants and donations, which increased 50-fold in the days following the budget announcement. Volunteer signups also increased by 500%. Meals on Wheels delivers 218 million meals a year to individual homes and senior centers, feeding 2.4 million Americans age 60 and older. There's more to read at eartheats.org, and we always post more news stories on Earth Eats Twitter feed.
Our weekly update with Mark Chilla. Thanks, buddy.
Yep. See you next week.
Midwest farm country is home to rows and rows of wheat, corn, and soybeans. But low crop prices have conventional farmers looking for ways to supplement their incomes. One possibility? Producing food for farmers markets. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Brian Thompson has the story.
When you picture a Kansas farm, Phil Holman Hebert's operation in Jefferson County is probably not what comes to mind. He has only 63 acres, and none of it is producing cash grain crops. It's hilly pasture land, but there are no cattle on it. There are, however, about 900 chickens.
They're just hanging out being chickens. Those cooing noises that they're making right now are, I think, one of the ways you can tell the chickens are happy. They're comfortable.
These chickens are producing pasture-fed eggs. Depending on the size, Holman Hebert gets up to $5.50 a dozen for them at area farmers markets. He also sells eggs to restaurants in the nearby college town of Lawrence.
Food is a multi-billion dollar economy in Kansas.
Misty Lechner sees that as a huge opportunity. Part of her job with the American Heart Association is to help local governments encourage the development of local food systems.
If we can change that to increase local food sales by just 1% in Kansas, we're talking multi-million dollar impact on our local food economies.
Conventional farmers are struggling to cope with low prices for commodities like wheat, corn, and sorghum. But local food, like those eggs, fetches a premium. So with net farm income forecast this year at roughly half of what it was a few years ago, why aren't row crop farmers moving en masse into vegetables? Kansas State University agricultural economist Michael Taylor says that transition is more difficult than you might think.
You have to not only harvest your crop and transport it to the market, but if you're in a farmer's market, say, you then have to set up a table, you have to make it look good, you have to have an employee sit there and for the day and sell that product and interact with consumers.
You need to be located close enough to the farmer's market to keep transportation expenses down. And then there's the labor issue.
The planting, the pruning, the harvesting, all of it requires a lot more hand labor. So that has a very different requirement than what it takes to run a combine.
In fact, labor is the main concern keeping Andy and Lavelle Windsor from switching a little bit of their land near Grantville, Kansas, from row crops to gardens. I spoke with Lavelle at a meeting about the local food scene.
Our challenge as a farm is how to make that fit with what we already know that we do fairly well, and to make that work with the equipment and the land and the labor that we have already.
Farmers like the Windsors have huge investments in the kind of equipment needed to farm huge tracts of land in corn, soybeans, and wheat. And it's just about all they can do to keep up with the work that entails.
Yeah, the black beans have been really good for us, something that we can grow in the area.
That's Jake Johannes, who farms a wide range of specialty crops for local customers.
And I'd say, in terms of conventional growers wanting to diversify, I think that diversifying in regard to dry beans and edible beans is a really great way to go.
He says farmers can use a regular combine to harvest the beans, which may prevent the need for new equipment. Black-eyed peas are another option. They produced a good yield for Johannes, but tended to clog the combine with their tough vines and pods. Black beans produced lower yields, but Johannes says that improved when he harvested them by hand. But that comes back to the problem of expensive labor.
Farms around here, you've got someone managing 3,000 to 4,000 acres of row crops and then asking them to take on even an acre vegetable patch. It's a completely different business.
Losing money is a powerful motivator for farmers to take a look at diversifying. But experts say the number one thing to keep in mind, new crops are a long-term commitment, not a stopgap. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
Get more farm news from Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Iowa, and Colorado at harvestpublicmedia.org. Georgina Ramsey wasn't expecting to focus her research on food when she started working with refugees. But as an anthropologist, she says it's her job to focus on what's important to the people she's working with. And the issue that seemed to impact everyone's daily lives in Uganda was the fear of poisoning. Ramsey is a visiting scholar at Indiana University. Her research started with resettled women in Australia, and then she traced their paths back to Kampala, Uganda. She lived in camps and in urban settings with women displaced from the Democratic Republic of Congo. To set up the story, Ramsey describes how she ate when she was in Kampala.
Right, so in Kampala, well,
When I first got there, me and my friend who I was living with, we had a decent amount of money. So we kind of got there and flashed our money a little bit. So we were buying things like milk. Milk is a really sort of important food. Eggs, meat. A lot of the refugees would only eat meat once a year. So we were sort of leading this extreme lifestyle. Then the money started to slow down. So we were eating what everyone else was eating, which is leaves. Primarily cassava leaves, martembella, which is sweet potato leaves. Occasionally some dried fish would be put in there. And then we would have some kind of like meal. So that would be maize or cassava meal as well.
Maddie Chera and Lee Bush of the Indiana University Food Institute take the story from here. You'll hear Maddie first.
Was there like a specific moment or event that made you realize it was so important to people?
Yeah. So I had started my research with refugees in Australia. So I sort of knew how commensality, so sharing food, worked there. Sharing and basically bringing that person into your family or your household for that temporary moment. So it's a very socially loaded thing to do. So when I got to Uganda and I was living with these refugees in Kampala, I just assumed it would be the same situation. Yeah. And suddenly no one was talking about food. And I thought, that's really, really, really odd. And I guess the moment that it really stuck out to me just how serious this was because one night I was sitting in the room with the woman I was living with and her family. So at different points I was living with maybe like, I don't know, between 5 and 9 refugees at a time, like in a 2-bedroom apartment. So it was pretty full on. Oh. So we were sitting there. We had enough food because we had come from Australia, but there were other families there. And I remember hearing these little children across from me in the apartment block crying. And I knew it was because they didn't have food that night. So I was kind of like, well, should we just, you know, we've got extra, we should just give it to them. And the woman I was with was like, oh, there's no point. And I was like, why? Yeah. I'm like, that's really mean. Like, this is, you know, these children are starving. And she was like, well, they're just going to throw it out. They're not going to take it. So there's no point. And I saw people throwing food out. So I knew that she was being serious about that. That's how real the threat was.
What are some of the sort of strategies or tactics that people would use to avoid poisoning?
So basically, people would pretend not to eat, right? Or to have meals, which, I mean, the reason I didn't set out to study food, but as an anthropologist, you're working with people and you're working with everyday life generally, and food is a part of everyday life. So that just, I had to talk about it.
Right.
So that meant that it was really strange to me when I got to this context in Kampala where suddenly, you know, at certain times of the day, people would just disappear as if nothing was happening.
Huh.
Especially because in Australia, that was the time when people would appear to eat, because in a lot of the cultural groups I was working with, you only really eat one meal a day, like a big family meal, and that's at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 to 4.
Right.
So, yeah, at that time of day, people just slowly taper off. And then we'd be cooking food in very protected sort of environments. So you would not be cooking outside, which is something that was really strange to me. I'd seen that a lot in Australia.
Yeah. So how did this come to be? I mean, what is... I don't know how to ask the question.
How do people describe the poison? What do they worry about?
Yeah, it was... I mean, I tried to get to that. But that's the whole, if you look in the anthropology of myths and logics and rationalities, it's really hard to get people to elicit and actually express what is something that is just so obvious to them. So
True. And
whenever I tried to sort of ask about the details, like how do people get poisoned? Like how does it get into the food? Where does it come from? I would get this pretty standard response of, oh, well, how would I know? I don't poison people. Huh. And I was like, yeah, of course, I get it. So like the more questions I ask, the more it's like I'm kind of accusing them of doing these things. But I managed to get bits and pieces of information. So I think the general sense was that when you're working with populations of refugees, they are generally groups of people they come under this one block of refugee. So that's the label. Mm-hmm. But they're all different ethnic backgrounds, clan backgrounds, language groups. So, and these are the same ethnic backgrounds and clan groups and language groups that are killing each other from where they're coming from. So even though they're in a space of asylum, they're still feeling insecure and unsafe, regardless of what's actually, if there's any evidence for that. They feel insecure.
Because some of them are side by side with the people who are persecuting them, is that right?
Yeah. In the place I was living, that was the case. But the refugees I worked with who'd been in camps, and I worked with a lot of refugees who were coming out of camps as well, they told me that they had been poisoned, most of them.
Huh.
So I was working with like a teenage guy who had been poisoned, and his symptoms were like just basically he would be getting stomach pains and he wouldn't be able to eat and he would vomit, and that would happen like for weeks on end. And I mean, I also have a background in medical anthropology, so you could be looking at that and saying, well, you know, there's a lot of biomedical causes for that kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But from their perspective, this is a, whatever it is, it's stemming from the general insecurity of life.
Right.
It's both a physical insecurity. It's definitely a physical insecurity because people are struggling with the materiality of living as a refugee, which is not easy, even in Uganda, which has one of the best, supposedly, asylum policies in the world. So you have this issue where you have a limited resource,
mm-hmm.
but then you also have this intense social insecurity because you're surrounded by people you can't trust. And then you've got this existential insecurity. It's like, well, what's my future going to be? I don't know how to make a life here. I don't know how to provide for my children here. I want them to have a better life than I have, but there's no way to do that. So you're stuck in this impasse. So it comes out in ways like avoiding poison. So then they would tell me the only way to solve it is to get resettled. So that didn't surprise me at all. It's like, well, if we come to Australia, we'll be better again.
I see.
And I'm like, yeah, okay.
So the poison issue wasn't a factor in Australia in the resettled groups?
No, no.
Coming up, what happens when these refugees finally do make it to Australia? Lee Bush and Maddie Chera continue their conversation with Georgina Ramsey. And then, eat your flowers. Quick, I want to touch base on our effort to spread the good word about podcasts this month. How's it going? Are you giving your friends and family some good recommendations? Showing them how easy it is to download and listen to podcasts? And are you bragging about your successes on Twitter? Hashtag TryPod is where the conversations are happening. That's T-R-Y, pod. You're doing a good thing for the podcasts and the people you love. Thanks. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. The article Georgina Ramsey wrote about this issue of poisoning is titled Avoiding Poison: Cosmological Understandings of Urban Refugee Displacement in Uganda. It was published in the International Journal of Social and Cultural Practice in 2016.
Earlier, she mentioned that as an unmarried woman with no children, she was an anomaly to the women she worked with. For them, having children gave them a sense of security, especially after they were resettled in Australia. Their children represented their future. She tells Lee and Maddie how a conversation over planting cassava turned into commentary about their new home.
These women were trying to recreate their worlds, and they couldn't grow cassava.
And why is that?
The temperate climate just didn't allow it, but they kept trying. So they were like putting these little seedlings into the ground and just watching them die.
Wow. And which is fascinating considering what seems to be harsh conditions from where they're coming and are much more fertile conditions where they are.
Yeah.
But there's still infertility.
Yes, exactly. In many ways. So yeah. I had this one encounter where I was actually gardening with one of the women in Australia, and the conversation turned to why I didn't have children, as it inevitably always did. And we sort of planted them, and I said, oh, how do you think they're going to go? And she was like, well, they'll probably die, just like everything else in this country. There's no life here. She looked at my stomach and she's like, there's no life. You know, this is a country where there's no life. And I was going from being in Uganda where people were like, we need a new life in Australia. So there's this huge existential shock that occurs when the things that you take for granted are not available. So they ended up getting cassava from markets in Sydney, and they were living about 3 hours away from Sydney. They'd go to Sydney, buy frozen cassava leaves that had been imported from the Pacific Islands to cook at home. And that was always really exciting, but because they had to eat cassava. There was no way they couldn't not eat this food, for the Congolese at least. And they told me, it's okay. It's never the same. Everything's different here. This is basically, they were saying that this is artificial. It's coming from a plastic thing. Like everything else in your country is fake and doesn't actually have this sense of life in it. So,
and yet, on the flip side of that, they can eat together and outside and cook together and outside and don't fear being poisoned.
Exactly.
They tell you at least.
Yeah, yeah. So there is this very strange constellation of worlds that happens in Australia.
So more security in a sense, but
that existential loss is still there.
Yeah.
So you get the social security. So as I said, if you're going to compartmentalize it into physical, social, and existential, you manage. Australia resolves the physical and the social for the most part, although I argue, depending on your circumstances, it doesn't. But physical and social, but it doesn't resolve existential displacement.
Georgina Ramsey of Indiana University, soon to be an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Delaware. Her forthcoming book is titled Impossible Refuge, The Control and Constraint of Refugee Futures. She spoke with IU Food Institute's Maddie Chera and Lee Bush. We're cooking up recipes that use wild foods in all of our March shows. Daniel Orr plucked some nasturtiums and marigolds for a very pretty little tea sandwich. But first, we give the birds a break from their constant foraging by making a suet cake.
Well, whenever you have your little birds over for dinner, it's always nice to give them something they love. And this recipe is perfect for all kinds of woodpeckers and other birds that might be coming around to your backyard. And what we're going to do is just mix together a bunch of ingredients. It's no bake, so it's the easiest thing possible. I've got some lard right here. Then we're going to add some peanut butter. And then we're just going to mix in all the other little grains. We've got some cornmeal. We've got some wonderful rolled oats. Got some bird seed, which I have millet and sunflower seeds. Then we're going to, for those birds that have a sweet tooth, we're going to add some raisins. We're just going to mix to incorporate those. And a funny thing is that we're going to add some cayenne pepper. A lot of people would think that birds wouldn't like cayenne pepper, but they love chilies. And so we just make this into a really nice thick cake. Okay, and then we just have some molds. What I've done is I've put a little bit, you could take a cat food can or any kind of little tin or a hummus container, rub a little bit of water inside, and then you push your plastic wrap in there, and it will stick to the water that you put inside there. So it's a nice way to line any type of mold for baking. So then I've spread these evenly inside, and then what we do is we take that, we put it in the freezer, let it firm up, and then you can just pull them out and fold the plastic wrap over. And then you can just kind of tap them out once they're frozen. You've got these wonderful little cakes. And then you could nail these to a tree, and hopefully you'll have a lot of visitors to your birdseed table. This is a simple, really fun, old-fashioned dish. It's finger sandwiches. And one of my friends, Dee Dee, over in Columbus, Indiana, she remembers when she was a kid eating these nasturtium butter sandwiches. And we think that would be very trendy and very kind of she gourmet stuff. But they've been eating this kind of stuff for years. And, you know, if you know the English and their high tea, they eat watercress sandwiches and other little finger sandwiches. So this is kind of based on the same thing. And what we're going to start with is a compound butter. Now, compound butter just means that you're taking butter and you're seasoning it. Today I've got some garlic, about a quarter of a teaspoon. We don't want to have it real strong because, remember, we're making dainty little tea sandwiches. Okay, so we're just going to smash that down, make it a nice paste. Okay, we have about a half teaspoon of lemon zest, which we use a lot here on Earth Eats. It's one of our favorite little flavors. We're going to add just a little bit of fresh lemon juice to 3 tablespoons of butter. And we're just going to season that with a little salt and pepper, just a pinch. All right, I've got some rye bread here that we've toasted on the grill, and we're going to spread it with the butter, and it will look like quite a bit of butter because you really want it to hold on the leaves and the decorations. Now we're going to just sprinkle it with some basil leaves. I have the baby basil, the micro basil. Then I've got these nasturtium leaves. Okay, and I'm going to take apart a marigold and just put a little bit of the leaf petals on top of the butter and push those down. You can serve it whole like this, which I think is really pretty. And there you go. That is our nasturtium and edible flower tea sandwich.
I especially love that recipe for just how simple it is. And that compound butter is good to have around the kitchen. A big thanks to everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant and Chef Daniel Orr. These recipes are posted at eartheats.org. A special shout out this week to Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the Indiana University Food Institute. Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo write our news stories. Abon Binder and Mark Chilla are partners at WFIU. And John Bailey is Earth Eats executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Wharton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Big news before I let you go today. Our new book of recipes and gardening tips and interviews is out. You can buy it now on Amazon.com, just search for Earth Eats. We are so excited about the book. All right, till next time, I'm Annie Corrigan.